Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi guys, I'm Jamie Oliver and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. How amazing. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and so much more. It's been 10 years, and they're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Stephen Bitteroff. We'll talk to Stephen about Riesling Fire, Von Boden. We'll talk to him about his love for Teutonic wines and more. For our weekly wine sip, I don't know what the hell we're going to taste. Stephen brought in a bag of wine, so we'll drink through that during the show. I'm your host, Sam Van Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right, hailing from Pennsylvania, Stephen Bitteroff left New York to study art, eventually becoming an artist, true. His love and interest in wine brought him from art to wine, working in retail and ultimately wine importation. Stephen is the creator of Riesling Fire, a celebration of Riesling, and the proprietor of Von Boden, a boutique wine import company specializing in German wines, among others. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Stephen.
Thank you, Sam. Good to be here, man.
Great to have you. I think the best way for our audience to get to know you is for you to give us a little background, as I ask all my guests, about your journey in life and wine that got you to really where you are today, which is throwing this great Riesling Fair and your boutique importation company. But it was an interesting road, so...
Yeah, it was not direct.
Yeah.
For sure. So how did it start? I mean, any journey in wine starts with drinking a lot. Drinking probably too much. But before that, so I think you mentioned the intro. I left New York to study art. I came to New York.
You came to New York.
Yeah, so basically I grew up for the most part in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And then after that, went to Penn State.
Sorry about the Steelers.
Yeah, honestly, I don't follow sports at all. So good. I went to Penn State, which is a huge football town, and
big.
Never went to a game. Studied art history. I mean, you know, it's like...
There's why.
Yeah, dude. I wore a lot of black and didn't go to any of that shit. Can I swear or no?
Yeah.
Okay. Studied art history. The plan, so far as I had a plan, was to get my PhD in art history. I went to Chicago. I did an internship at the Art Institute of Chicago. I came to New York specifically to study contemporary German painting with one very specific professor. He said no, and then I kind of didn't know it. The plan had been like A to B to C to D. You know, it's like it was all very well laid out, at least in my head. And then when that happened, I didn't know what the hell to do because I was in New York. I was waiting on tables. The plan was in the fall to do that, and then the door was closed there, so boom.
That was it, huh?
So I was, at the same time I was drawing, I was doing pretty big drawings.
Always drawing, or kind of started?
Yeah, I'd never in my life, and still haven't ever taken a studio art class, so I don't have any formal training whatsoever, but I was doing big drawings, and a lot, you know, it's like, I come from a kind of middle-class Pittsburgh family,
right?
As did Andy Warhol, I guess. But it was like art as a career was not, it just wasn't something people talked about ever, right? So it seemed incomprehensible and improbable. So yeah, I was doing big drawings. I had a room full of them, but never honestly did I ever think of selling them or that would be anything feasible or possible. But then people started buying them.
How? How are they friends?
You know, you hang out with people in New York. You know, you meet some people who are collectors. I was in that world, right? So you meet people at openings, you go to studios, that sort of shit. And I wasn't making that much work. So yeah, I started selling it, and then I got a gallery, and then it kind of.
I
had a gallery, yeah. I had a gallery in New York and one in London. Cool. And sold it, you know. I don't know. I sold some work, you know. I could, like, pay the bills for a little bit with that shit.
Really?
Yeah, for a few years. And then I got through that. I was already into wine. I was waiting on tables. It was all part of, like, the world. And doing it on the cheap. I know this sounds, like, very fancy, but it was, you know. It was
Go back for a second. I mean, no family influence on wine. No around the table stuff or. Where was it any of that? Was New York the place where you were exposed to it, working tables and it being around?
Yeah, I would say kind of 100%. Interestingly, my father's from Austria. So my father's Austrian, and presumably, we didn't really speak about it that much, but presumably drank a lot of white wine growing up. And so when he came to the U.S., he fell in love with, like, really powerful red wines. So certainly wine was a part of, like, the dinner table, but not in a... Neither in a connoisseur in a way of connoisseurship, right. So he wouldn't, you know, present to me a Burgundy.
More of a compliment.
Yeah, it was like there was always wine on the table, and it was like, right. If you wanted a schlug, you got it. But it was not a formal thing. My father drank Magnums that were $10 and less, and like the Shiraz, right? It was just right. I think after being raised in Austria in the 50s and 60s and having a lot of really insipid white wines, like wanted some alcohol and fruit, and there it goes.
So. Here's the part I don't get. I mean, your whole life is about wine. I mean, what was that moment? I mean, you know, we didn't finish the art thing. I mean, you had a gallery represent you, you're drinking. When was the moment where you knew wine, like, this is cool or I never had this? Was it a specific wine? Was it a time? I mean, why and when?
Yeah, no, there's no specific, there's no, like, you know. It was a
moment.
Sam, it was a 1961 right. Palmer. No, it was, I mean... I would say it was probably a German Riesling, you know, or German wines back in the that were just that changed how I perceived what you could experience through wine. Insofar as they had residual sugar, they had so much acidity. There was this like this yin yang.
And you're making sense of all of this back then, or thinking a little about it.
I was registering it as a really like phenomenal experience.
Well, register is a fair word.
Exactly.
Too. Yeah. All right. So the art thing is, you know, gallery representation, selling a little, you know, get me to the transitions now, the wine and, you know, keep going.
Yes. Okay. So the short story, because this can be a very long story.
Okay.
The short version is basically that the gallery world, I was successful enough to like keep the lights on and, you know, have kind of cup of noodles, but was not wildly successful or even was really not even that successful.
Okay.
All right. Let's put this in context.
Honest.
And got more and more into wine. Felt like it just seemed more interesting. And to be honest, now looking back, there's some logic to it, right? I get more into wine. And I got more into wine both from the tasting. I was drinking and buying a lot, right? And collecting on a very humble level. Like, you know, I'd have a case of wine around. I would be very conscientious of what I was drinking, interested in this wine or that. They might be a $5, $10, $15 bottle of wine, but I was interested in where it came from, who was making it, right? So collecting on that more
inquisitive,
cerebral level, and was interested in where they came from and like why wines from Germany were different than Italy, different than Spain, different from France. I was interested in the geography. I was interested in the history of it. I was interested in the language. And that is kind of like, that is what I did in art history. That is art history, right?
Right.
And to some extent, whether you're studying a painting or a sculpture from Italy or from France or from Germany or a wine, they're cultural products, right? And so it kind of
feels... More than people know.
Yeah, for sure, right? There's a reason Italian wine tastes different than German wine. There's a reason that the German Renaissance looks different than the Italian Renaissance, right? These are cultural artifacts. And that was the fascination. That what drew me in. And looking back... It's like, yeah, man, I just threw out art history and brought in wine because it's a similar thing. You get to travel, you get to work on language, you get to work on history, you get to work on geography. Those are all the same things. And
so
wine you can drink.
How'd you make that a vocation?
So that was a lot of lucky timing, right? It's the moment I got into it was the kind of, let's say, the early 2000s. And it was a time when wine was... how do you say? Like, was fatiguing from the Robert Parker kind of world, right? So, you know, for people who are not knee deep in this or not inside baseball. There was a time when wine was made. Then there was a time where Robert Parker kind of ruled the roost. And it was the first time, perhaps, that there was a kind of stylistic unity where the market identified, okay, people like high alcohol, or they like more sugar, or they like
big
new
fruit,
wood, or all whatever these things are, right? And it was a time when that was, and so people clamored around that. And frankly, you know, it's easy to bash Parker and what he did and simplifying, but it's also like, you know, it was a way of bringing it into millions of households, right? That is to some extent fueled where we are today, where
true,
we can talk about small production, dorky
it's
wine.
A good peripheral point.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like there's always a flip side, right? So it was a time when that narrative was beginning to break apart. And so I got lucky and went to, you know, I was basically getting very serious about wine and was kind of doing it all on my own and felt like at this point I was doing art. I was doing a bunch of other weird freelance shit. And I said, you know what? If I can work 1 or 2 days a week at a wine store, like make enough to, you know, make enough to just kind of like pay for my time there. But, you know, I'm doing other things. That's really the where I make my bread. But I can buy wine at cost and I can meet other people into wine. And so it was very much just like I'm going to meet people, hang out, buy some more wine. And it just was a good time. And so I was able to communicate. I'm a decent writer. I was able to kind of work on an email program and to do a little bit more digital marketing, which was at the that time a kind of new idea.
Right.
And to do it outside of the rubric. That was the big breakthrough, was kind of doing this as not, I'm not taking ownership of this. I was a part of a group that did this. But it was breaking away from the Parker thing and not, you know, it's hard to think
now,
out.
Clear up something for me. Is this something you were doing on your own or you're already working somewhere doing this?
So this is the transition moment where I was collecting wines, getting really serious and felt like I wanted to get into the biz. And so I applied to a number of different wine stores in New York and I was hired at Crush.
Weren't they relatively new then?
Brand new. Yeah. So I think they opened in March of 2005 and I started working there June, something like this, right?
And from the opening, because if you go in there now, they're pretty committed to some, you know, interesting wines and depth and all of that. Was that the case at the beginning or you guys in there and there were a bunch of you got them?
Yeah, no, from the beginning.
That was a vision?
Yeah, from the beginning, it wasn't my vision, but from the beginning, it was a kind of eclectic mix of kind of what we now call kind of geeky eccentric wines and like high-end collectible. And that was the initial wine buyer there. That was his palate and his insight. And, you know, so from the beginning, it kind of was that.
So Crush is a wine store that still exists in New York City in the mid-high 50s
exactly,
on the east side.
Yeah.
And it's considered, you know, one of the better wine stores. So you're there. It's funny. Whoever's there early on influences, you know, what's going to be there, where their strengths or specialties become. So you kind of stay there for a while, grow through the ranks.
Yep.
Walk me through that.
Yeah, so basically, I was doing at the time, you know, I studied art history, and art history was, it's a lot of essay writing, right? It's a lot of communication. It's a lot of formulating thoughts and kind of reducing them or distilling them into concrete ideas, right? Chunks. And so this was the time that the Parker narrative, so in other words, these, you know, like 100 point, this was a time where email marketing was essentially Robert Parker, 98 points, 1999, right?
And a shelf talker.
A shelf talker, three words. It usually involved like jammy, right? But most important, it had the points and it had the price. So it all boiled, whether you had a sexy picture or not, or graph, it all boiled down to 1999, 97 points, or whatever your calculus was, right? 99 points, $24.99, whatever it is. And so Crush, and again, I'm not taking ownership. I was one of a team, but, you know, our insight, and not even our insight, our passion was just to be like, dude, it's not interesting. A lot of these wines we didn't really like. And it's looking back now, it feels very prescient, but at the time, you know, going heavy in Burgundy and Germany and Austria and Northern Rhone and the Loire Valley and a lot of places that now are very staked out and established was a little bit more risky, right? We were certainly losing some money to the people doing like the Molly Dukers, if you remember those wines.
People would walk in and look for that.
Yeah, they'd want that stuff and we didn't have it.
Did Wine Spectator have sway on what people would? Not as much as Parker?
I mean, I think they were all part of the voice.
Yeah.
I don't think they were that much different in terms of what they were really celebrating, right? And so Crush's Insight and a number of other very good retailers, Chamber Street as well, like another one still exists. They were the ones searching for the stories, right? And selling Crush, we made a point never to mention points. Even if we were selling a high right. rated point, it was just like, dude, that's not important. What's important is the winemaker, the region he's coming from. And so we did pretty elaborate emails. I mean, the production value and the time spent on these emails in the long run worked. But at first it was, I remember writing an email on Emidio Pepe. You know those wines?
Oh, sure.
It was called, I still remember, it was one of the first emails
they were
I
did. Probably much cheaper
oh,
then.
Oh, man, yeah. It was like, you know, you get wines from the 70s and 80s that were,
crazy.
I don't know, 60 bucks, 70 bucks. But I remember working on this email, and we had a whole thing of like, where is the region and the grapes and how they do this? We had sidebars, pictures. I still remember the title was Ballerina in Boxing Gloves. And I spent probably like 2 days of work on this email.
Really?
When, you know, content, breaking it down, looking at pictures, going through massive edits. How do we do this? Blah, blah, blah. And I think we sold like 8 bottles. You know, but you know, 3 years later, it was going well. So that was the break of doing, of telling a story, right? Of not using points, of using the more complicated narrative, of really going into the details. And now again, it seems kind of like it seems obvious, but at the time, it was a little bit of a leap of faith.
Did most people come in looking for a story and a recommendation, or a good deal of them had something in mind? Some could be swayed. But like you said, the Parkerization, you didn't have it, they walked out. I mean, how did that go at the very beginning?
At the very beginning, it was something we had to deal with, for sure. And, you know, compromises were made. I mean, there were certain big brands that we would have just because, you know, you have 10 people a day walk in and want one wine, like, after a while. And it was less dogmatic. It was honestly more, as I think most great things are, it was driven by what you really care about. You know, it's like everyone can say, man, I have this great idea for a company that does this. But if you don't want to spend your like morning, afternoon and night thinking about this, it's not going to happen. You have to do something you actually give a
right.
shit about.
Right.
So it was less dogmatic. Like, we didn't want to make money and selling these easy brands to sell. It was more, man, like, what really keeps you going are these kind of geekier things. And it was just, again, it was good timing. It was, the market was changing.
Yeah.
And it was viable. And we were ahead of the curve, along with, you know, others as well, but we're along the curve. So to your question, would people, yeah, people walk in and, you know, 10% of them would be like, I want wine X. We don't have wine X.
But try this going on for 78 yeah. bucks. Well, that's a little pricey yeah. and I don't know it.
But people,
you wish you bought 10 of them.
Yeah, people were ready for a change. And at the time, wines weren't that expensive, right? So you could sell people on Clos Rouge Blanche, or you could sell people on a lot of the Dresdner book, a lot of the great Loire producers, frankly, the great Beaujolais producers, who now are still cheap, right?
Right, good values.
Yeah, and you could sell people on Briords and on...
So you spend how many years?
So there, Crush? About 9 years, 8, 9 years.
And like a bunch of questions. One, you know, towards the end, what were you doing? Two, during the journey, you know, where'd this love for, you know, these Teutonic, these Rieslings and German wines? And I know you were interested in other yeah. areas. And then the transition out of there, you know, walk me through all that.
Yeah. So beginning, you know, I think my first official, like, full-time. So basically I remember going in there. I'm going to like step one, step back, because it's fairly entertaining. I remember walking in there and, you know, it's like, I knew wine well enough, right? I had a good base level. So I walk in, I'd done a number of interviews and, you know, kind of had to talk a lot about wine. It's like, great, great. So I walk in, I think I'm a salesperson. And I'm working 2 days a week, I think, and I walk in. And like, oh, how you doing? Great, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then sort of like, all right, you know, head on into the stock room, and there's a bunch of cardboard to break down. And I'm like, whoa. And, you know, I don't know, I'm in my late, I think I was 28 or 29 at the time. And I'm like, and I either just got married or was engaged. You know, like, I'm a man, Sam. You know what I mean?
I ain't cutting boxes.
Yeah, down. And I call my wife and I go, at the same time, I study art history and have no ego. So, you know, it's like, whatever, man. I had no money, no ego. It's all good. But I remember calling my fiance and just going, I think I'm a stock boy. And she goes, that's okay, sweetie. That's okay.
Do you have one of those cutters?
Yeah, for sure, man. Of course. So anyway, so I start off as salesperson / stock boy. My first title was director of marketing. Basically, like, I wrote the emails, right? That was...
Is that because you were the most literary and literate guy, or just...
Yeah, I think,
default.
Yeah. I could bloviate the most.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could string sentences together. So that's what I did, and all as well as sales. So I did a lot of sales, and it was, you know, that was the time when there weren't every email people got who were in the wine world, right? Was again, 98 points, 1999. So to get emails, it was like, we're pushing weird stuff. And we certainly would do bigger brands. We do the wines, but we would also do a lot of weird stuff, including German Austrian wines, Swiss wines, Loire wines were not that well known, right? So there was a whole diversity. And then from there, became Wine Buyer with the wine buyer is still currently there. So it was a partnership, honestly, it was always kind of a partnership. There were always like 2 to 3 to 4 key people doing stuff. I was one of them. And then my last title was wine director.
Okay.
So that meant, and this was a big issue. So it was going from being involved in wine day to day as buyer, author, writer, seller, to, the wine director it's basically general manager, right? It's
a little more...
Yeah, you're running global. Yeah, you're running the store. There's HR. There's a lot of non-wine right. things to deal with. And at that point, my interests, German and Austria, was a huge, huge interest of mine.
Just because you had the exposure?
I don't know.
They had the inventory. You liked it. I mean, why does that break through?
One of my first wine epiphanies was kind of German Austrian wines. It just has always been a passion. I like acidity. I like cool climate. Germany specifically, and the Mosel even more specifically, have a direct connection to land and to history, right? It's very much Burgundian, so it's a monastic culture that very much detailed the vineyard sites and everything else over hundreds of years. So there's just like a lot. For a geek who wants to read books, there's a lot of raw material out there, and I like the wines. So it seemed like a natural fit. I also like the underdog, you know what I mean? It's... In terms of starting an import company, it's like, man, the world needs another French importer. Like it needs a hole in its head.
Right.
And there's a real dynamism in Germany right now, in Austria as well, in a lot of these countries, right? And as you go further east in Hungary and Slovakia and a lot of these places, and they need champions. You know, it's like these other places don't. So I felt like with my father's, my cultural connection there, I speak German, fairly well. I'd studied the culture there. I still have my father's entire family still lives in Vienna. I still have a decent amount of family in Germany. It just felt like this is probably the battle I should choose. And some of it, I'm not a religious man, but some of it was spiritual. It's like right. I'd gone to Germany a number of times and I've been to a lot of wine regions, but there is something about walking through the Mosel where I'm just like, you know what I mean? It's like there's a buzzing, everything works. You're like, I'm probably meant to be here.
So you're at the store 9 years and you're starting to talk about that transition into why and how you became an importer. Tell me, so here's your love for German wines. There's a connection that's very deep emotionally, all of that stuff. How do you get from working in retail to really going out on a limb and start an importation company?
Yeah, I was lucky. So there was a... So to set the context here, right? German wine, if people know it at all, they think of the kind of 70s Liebfrau Milch, Blue Nun, right? All that shit that's like mass produced.
Not even Riesling.
Yeah. It's all, sweet, mass production, commercial. It's a stable consumer product, but it's not necessarily like an agricultural product. It's not necessarily a product that's reflective of the deeper culture there. And it's also, Germany, it's one small part of a really wide and diverse wine culture. And the Germans are very good at, focusing on what works and learning to mechanize it and to increase it, right? So sweet wines were sweet wines of the 70s. The Liebfrau Milch was the natural wine of the 70s, meaning it was the hip thing to do. Everyone wanted it. It was the cool wine. I talked to a number of importers.
It's crazy.
Who were starting in the 60s and 70s and were like, dude, you had to have... German wine was like the $8 Montepulciano, man. You had to have that. That's what kept you, that's what kept the lights on where you're trying to sell hard shit like Burgundy, right? And Piedmont, right? You had the German wine, pay the bills, keep the lights on. That was your bread and butter. And then you could dabble in hard to sell shit like Northern Rhone and Burgundy and Loire, right?
But here's what I don't get. It disappeared.
Yeah. I mean, fashions do, right? Anything that...
But I mean cold.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody...
It's... You know what happened? It's one of these things that's... The quicker and the more dominant a force is, the quicker it goes down, right? Anything that rises, anything that shoots straight up, falls right to the ground. And it was a stylish thing within German wine, within the deeper historic context of German wine. Sweet wines are a part of it, but they were always a rarity. They're not easy necessarily to make. and they're more subtle wines. And so in the 60s and 70s, though, you know, it was a convergence of technology and everything else that they could all of a sudden produce mass quantities of these wines.
So that has to be one of the reasons for the misconceptions people have about, you know, German wine. I mean, Liebfrauenwulsch is not Riesling, but Riesling is prominent. So they're like, I don't like that.
Yeah, 100%.
So, you know, so you kind of push people out of that. So go back. So you're leaving the store,
right.
And
I was trying to set the timing and opportunity
for you to transition, right?
I was trying to set the context of wine just because that was the German wine, right? That's what everyone knew. And that's one small part. And there's a huge diversity of grapes, of styles, of regions, of everything, right? And there was a small import company called Mosel Wine Merchant that had been started roughly the same time I was at Crush. So let's say, you know, 06, 07, something like that. And they were bringing in really small production German wines, focusing a little bit more on dry styles. And it was, I don't want to overplay it, but I don't want to over, it was not exactly a revelation because I knew some of these producers, I tasted some of the wines, but it was really the first time that there was someone intelligent in the market talking about these wines and trying to sell them. And we were huge supporters at Crush, Chambers Street, a number of other places. Really, and it was a really, really small boutique import company that had a good business, a good arc, but it was a smaller company. And then finally the people kind of running it decided like that was, for a number of reasons. I think the business was fine. It was more just they wanted to do other things. And so it kind of stopped. And so a number of the producers that I'd been supporting through this import company all of a sudden didn't have representation. And it was really about a time where I never thought necessarily about importing wine. That, you know, it's like I didn't wake up one day and it's like, I want to import wine. I had no idea like how it works. I frankly still don't. But what I did know is that I wanted
logistics.
It's logistics, man. It's just like, you know, moving containers and that shit.
Yeah.
Oh man, it tires my brain. But I did know I wanted to be close to the growers. I'd done by this point a number of trips to Europe and a number of trips to wine regions. And like, to me, walking through the vineyards and meeting, like, they are the rock stars. They're the people.
You didn't want them to be unrepresented or left behind, right?
Yeah, it's just a really, you know, who knows why? You know, I could try and ascribe poetry to it, but you meet people I just knew I wanted to be close to the growers. And, you know, other people, and this is not judgmental at all, but other people in the business, you know, like the service element, right? They like, there's adrenaline in that. Other people like, in the retail game, you know, making the big sales and bringing, you know, these rare tranches, like, and I like all those things, but to me, being near the growers was a really, like, got me going. And so when the small import company decided to give up, I knew a lot of the producers. I literally happened to already have a trip booked. This, like, sounds too good to be true, but it's absolutely the truth. The week that the person told me the company was closing, I was going to Germany in a few days.
So you connected with the portfolio.
And, you know, initially it really was like, I want to keep you guys in the U.S. market. I know a bunch of people. I know a bunch of somms. I know other retailers. Like, let's just keep this going. And naive, maybe, in the sense that, like, I don't want these people not to be in the market anymore. And sure enough, I go there. I talk with them. Everyone's like, great. And I'm like, listen, on the positive side, I think I know your wines probably better than anyone else does. I was your biggest customer by country mile, and they all know this. On the downside, like, I have no idea actually how to import wine.
The business part.
Yeah, nor do I actually have a company or anything. But
did you reveal that to these guys?
Yeah, or they kept it aside? Yeah, no, they knew I was at Crush. You know, they knew me as Steven.
No, but did you reveal, like, okay, you know, I'm willing to represent you, you know, stepping from Mosel, but honestly, I don't know how to get the wine out of here.
And oh, yeah,
you
for
told
sure.
them all yeah, of that. Yeah, they
absolutely.
Weren't like, so why would I go with you? Or they were like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, some were.
Okay,
for sure. You know, honestly, this is the naive part, right? So I go there just thinking, like, not that I'm the savior by any means, but like, that I'm going to give them an opportunity they're not going to have, because otherwise, like, no one cares about German wine. And sure enough, like, some pretty serious people end up showing. So all of a sudden, I'm talking to growers, and they're like, yeah, that's interesting. You know, I'm giving my whole spiel. Like, listen, man, I know the wines. I love the wines. I want to sell them. And they're like, okay, well, we have a meeting tomorrow with Louis Dresner. And a few, and it's like, wait, who? You know?
Oh, boy.
It's like, all right, well, I'll take stage door left here and just exit now.
Stay in touch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so thank you for the opportunity and blah, blah, blah. And so at the end of the day, I did okay. You know, a few producers went with Louis Dresner. There was a few other importers there that, you know, picked up some growers as well. But I started with Lauer, Stein, and Weiser Künstler were the first three.
Wait, slow down that. So there were four producers
that said yes.
Are emotional because they were your first four.
Exactly right.
They were good.
Yeah.
They're still with you.
Yeah.
They're still great. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go over them again.
Yeah. So it was, I should probably say it was five.
Five?
So it was Lauer.
L-A-U-E-R.
L-A-U-E-R. Okay. So this is a producer in the Czar in the Mosel.
Okay.
Who now has become a fairly, you know, I work in such, you know, it should be said just again for the wider audience. I work in a small niche of a small niche. So when I talk about like famous producers, I'm talking about, you know, 5 to 10 to 20 degrees left of center, right?
Right.
This is in my little world. But Lauer's become a very important producer. I think it's established in Germany at large. Stein, who is a more eclectic, eccentric,
right,
kind of bohemian producer, but you know, in major markets, really well respected. I should say I'll go through and then I'll give my spiel. Weiser Künstler, who's a incredibly respected, truly one of the great producers of the Mosel. They farm 4 hectares, so you know, it's like I get zero wine from them.
Jesus.
A year. I mean, a lot of these, you know, the logistics, when you really talk about numbers, I will show people my allocation sometimes, and it's, you know, I know for a number of my producers I'm their biggest buyer, but for Weiser Künstler, I think this year was a tough year because of the vintage, but I think I got 20 cases of one of their cabinets for the United States of America, right? So it's, I don't know, that's, you know, that's 10 cases for New York and 2 cases each for 5 other states.
Spread,
I mean, these are insane amounts of wine, insanely small amounts of wine, right? This is why people in general don't do what I'm doing, because it is like borderline inane. You know,
one case is like 100 cases. It's the same work.
Exactly right. Yeah. You're doing all the admin, all the compliance, all the same to move 10,000 cases versus 5 cases. Right. So it doesn't make sense, except that I think the product is slightly better. I think people connect more with that ideology, right? That in all the crap,
totally,
and all the shit that's
so
going on
Lauer,
right now.
You got Stein.
I got Stein, Weiser Künstler, and then this young producer, Julian Hart.
H-A-A-R-T.
H-A-A-R-T. There's a lot of hearts in the Mosel.
Julian, J-U-L-I-A.
Yeah, Julian, yeah.
Okay.
So really small producer who was it was his first vintage when I was starting. 2011 was just the first that he kind of made on a commercial scale, at least. And then this other guy, Keller, who's a really big name in German wine. Do you know Klaus Peter Keller?
K-E-L-L-E-R.
Yeah, Keller. So he makes, you know, he was one of the first to really focus on making dry wines and has become very much a cult figure. You know,
yeah.
Just to put it in context, his top dry wines at this point sell for, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a bottle. So, and he was someone I met years and years and years and years ago, kind of before he was a rock star, just being really interested in German wine. And we became very, very good friends. So when I started my company, he said, listen, I have importers from most states, but any state I'm not working in, you can work in. So I started with him. So those were kind of the initial five.
Pretty lucky.
Yeah, for sure.
That, you know, those were the guys available.
Yeah.
Stephen, we have to take a break. It's a good time to cut out. When we come back, let's talk about the wines specifically.
Yeah.
We'll talk, you know, more about some of the producers. I want to talk about varietals and a bunch of other things. And I want to talk about Riesling Fire, which is really a celebration of all these guys, how you bring them to the public. We're talking to Stephen Bitterhoff. Stephen is the creator of Riesling Fire, which is a big Riesling Fair coming up in New York. We're talking about his import company, Von Boden, and we'll talk about a little more. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be back in a minute or so.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Stephen Bitteroff. Stephen is the proprietor of Von Boden and the creator of Riesling Fire, which we'll all get into. We got an idea of how Stephen got the business started, and he's being a little humble because some of the winemakers that he talked about are truly cult figures and rock stars now, which is interesting because when you started Von Boden, and I think you laid it out a little, I think you have had a mission, a philosophy. You know, I think it's to be small, your aspirations or not. You know, tell me about that. What's the philosophy of the company?
Yeah, for sure. That's critical. So, you know, as let me just go straight to, the question is the one ideology that I have and I believe deeply in is small scale. You know, we can talk within the wine world and frankly, you know, it's very easy to jump from wine to just agriculture, right? So to food and frankly to consumerism and to the world at large. But I do feel like scale is the most important thing, right? So within wine specifically, we can talk about organic viticulture. We can talk about biodynamic viticulture. We can talk about sulfur, about filtration, about a million different topics, right? And we can have very informed and intelligent opinions about these things. But really, to me, what's most important is the scale of it, which is to say a person in a place making good judgments based on their relationship with the land, right? There's an old Mennonite saying, and I don't know the exact saying, but the philosophy is basically like the Mennonites do not work with tractors with rubber tires because rubber tires allow you to drive further and to do more work. And it begins to skew the decisions being made. So if you're working on just a wheel with an iron wheel and you're driving on that, you have to go slower, you have to be more thoughtful, and it limits the amount of land you can farm. It limits the amount of produce you can make. It's a natural limitation that they put on that believe that just it's a more thoughtful and engaged.
So those are the type of producers.
Those are the type of
that
producers.
Are important. And based on what you said, you know, they're not jumping on a tractor and doing, you know, 28 hectares.
For sure, they're not small
producers that are very connected to the land.
Yes.
We forget it's an agricultural
exactly
product.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So that's who you.
That is, and this goes across. You know, so the majority of the book is the heart of the book is in Germany for sure. That said, I have producers in Austria and France and now a few domestic producers as well in the U.S. And that is the one correlating tie is that they are all small producers. And that is
the philosophy for the producers.
Exactly right.
They all buy.
Exactly
in.
Right. And it's not to say, too, that you can't make good wine on, and frankly, even great wine on a larger scale. I don't know that it's the relationship I think is best to have with the universe, nor oftentimes does it make the most interesting wines. You know. Again, we can get very meta on all this, but like, what do you really want in a bottle of wine? You want it to be delicious. That's important.
Right.
But like, frankly, I'd rather have an okay wine from a good human being than an awesome wine from Satan. Yeah, just to make it blatant, huh?
I think there is a movement towards that. I mean, you
I
and I
so.
Are sitting
yeah.
in the studio in Roberta's, which is ground zero yeah. for an eye towards, you know, natural wines and all of that. Sustainability.
Yeah.
You know, a recognition to the grower and all of
yep.
that. So we're in a good place that way. And
yep.
I think that's, you know, important for what you're doing. I'm just curious, when you got out of Germany a little, did people pursue you, you know, in the U.S. or France, or you thought, hey, what the hell, you know, I'm starting to figure this out. Let me talk to this guy, that guy. Had the portfolio expand
yeah.
beyond?
I don't even know that I can. I'm trying to think. So I'm trying to think what the first producer outside of Germany was. I believe it was a French producer, Migaud, which is in Lorraine. And so, you know, a lot of this is, it's just life, right? It happens to be that my wife's family, a lot of them are from Alsace, from Strasbourg,
really?
Right? So when I'm in Trier, it's about, I don't know, you know, depending how quickly you drive and the routes you take, it's about 2 hours south from Trier to Strasbourg. And so I drive through the Lorraine, and I'm interested in these regions, right? I mean, when you're driving through Europe, if you're curious, it's easy to go to Bordeaux, and it's easier to go to the Piedmont. It's easy to find these places that, you know, all signs point to. You've read a million books about them. They're on billboards. But, like, wine was a product and is a product that's produced in a million places by a million different people.
Unbelievable.
And the ones that are famous be for reasons that may or may not have anything to do with the quality of the wine, right? They may be close to a river. That tends to be, historically speaking, the reason why places are famous. Like, the reason that Bordeaux is a huge product historically is because it's really damn close to a big river. Right. It's the same with the Mosel, right? And Burgundy was in the shadows for a long time because it's harder to move. That's a bigger point. But the point is that there's a lot of little cultures, and some are celebrated and some are not, not necessarily based on the quality, but just based on, you know, historical factors that are in someone's control or not. So the Lorraine, to me, is wildly interesting. The Lorraine, for people who don't know, is kind of, it's a large swath of France on the eastern side, kind of above Alsace, you know, basically heading east from Paris, right? And it's this whole area that just was a huge viticultural area. There were two world wars that were fought basically in this area, switched back from France to Germany multiple times. There's bad phylloxera there as well as in lots of parts of France, but it had a lot of things that really knocked it down. And so there are not many acres under vine anymore, but it's also, because of this, it's also one of like the cheaper areas to live, right? It's one of the cheaper areas to make wine, to buy vineyard sites in the... There's real terroir there. So I would drive through this area.
Found
I'm generally
a producer.
Yeah, so I found a producer. It was recommended
so
by...
So you were intrigued and interested in the area.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
hit the road and That's like, it. Let me see if yeah. I can get one of these.
There were,
you know,
when you really get into this business at the level I'm at, it's not like I'm at a very sophisticated level, but like, you know, I spend a lot of my time talking with people, right? And somms tell me things. Retailers tell me things. People travel a lot and they go, man, I was... at this place and this wine was great. You should look into it. You know, and I kind of have a little flip book and I keep this stuff in. A
lot of good intel.
And so it's like, you know, I go visit them and 1 out of 100 tend to be what people say they are, right?
That's great. Let's talk about, like I said, when we took the break, I mean, we could talk about this stuff for 5 hours, but let's talk about the grapes and the varietals, you know, that make these wines. You know, Germany has built a reputation on the greatness, really, of a single grape.
Yeah, for sure.
What I want you to do is discuss other grapes. I mean, we talked about Riesling, and we know Germany's built around Riesling.
Yeah.
But I think we're at an exciting point, you know, where other grapes and producers are starting to spend time with these grapes. So let's talk about Germany beyond, you know, Riesling. What's happening? What's good? You know, what's in your portfolio you feel is important?
Yeah, okay. So I would say let's begin that discussion with saying, you know, in the great hierarchy of the wine world universe, right, many people, and I'd probably be one of them, will say that, you know, Riesling and Pinot Noir are at the apex, whether they're the best or, you know, it's like these are questions that I'm not very interested in, to be perfectly honest, but they are close to the apex, right? These are very noble grapes with deep histories. They can age. They show sight very specifically. These are among the gods of the grapes, right? That said, you know, diverse, you don't always want to listen to Beethoven. You know, sometimes you want to just chill out and, you know, listen to
Zeppelin.
A little Zeppelin or, you know, I don't know, the band down the street, right? That just has a good little tune. And so there's different places for all sorts of things. And Germany, you know, as with France, as with Italy, as with Spain, has a wildly diverse region, right? These are all little farming communities that kind of found their ways over centuries. And then, you know, and then started, and then there was more travel, there's more communication, and they blended a little bit. I think the analogy to make, the comparison to make, that maybe is interesting is Italy specifically. Because Italy, I feel like, is one of those countries that just did an incredibly good job of maintaining diversity and celebrating diversity, right? For sure, there's Sangiovese and there's Barolo and there are the quote-unquote greats, but there are a trillion DOCs there, a trillion different little regions, a bazillion grapes, and they all kind of are celebrated. They all have their voice, and they're not necessarily equal, but they're all celebrated, right? You talk to people very, very into Italian wine and very educated about it, and man, you will talk about the great historic Barolos with the same gusto that you talk about a white wine from Liguria, right? It's like these different places have a different
Sicily.
Yeah, they have a different vibe, a different flavor, a different geography, but they're all the diversity, the diversity of it is what makes it awesome, right? In Germany, as with France and a lot of the other places, it is exactly the same way in terms of the diversity, but in terms of the way the culture has celebrated is wildly different, right? So Germany made this hierarchy around Riesling because, one, it is such a great grape, as I said earlier, but two, because it was incredibly successful, both historically.
I was going to say, way back.
Yeah, going to the 18th, the end of the 19th
century. Kings were drinking Riesling, like, over Bordeaux in the old days.
I mean, you know, when you go back to the old, and you can still find these in, you know, cities. There was, when I was traveling in New Orleans a few years ago, someone gave me a wine list from a restaurant in New Orleans from the 1890s. And it is...
a lot of Riesling.
It's a lot of Riesling, and it's Bordeaux, and they're all priced about the same. Oftentimes, the Riesling's more expensive, right? And Burgundy is pretty cheap, comparatively speaking. But, you know, yeah, in the 1890s to the early 20th century, German white wine was the most expensive wine on the face of the earth.
Crazy.
And then there are two world wars. There's a lot of nonsense. And then in the 70s, it becomes fashionable again, right? So it has these spikes, and then it has these valleys. And German, you know, it's always been about Riesling. But the truth of the matter is it's a really diverse, it's a really, really
so
diverse
world. So let's talk about some interesting grapes. You know, let's focus on what's seeing some growth, what's available, who's committing to it.
All right. Let's see here. Just ask a question back to you. You mean like what I'm being successful with, or what's just kind of the market's interested in, or what I think is cool? Because these are all
I think all of them.
All right,
you know, and what your growers are committing some of the land to, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So I would say the Burgundian varietals, at least, you know, the varietals we associate with France and at large, right? So we're talking Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris. These are all varietals that have been grown in Germany for centuries. So they are, you know, while we think of them naturally as more French, that is their homeland. And I'm not going to sit here and argue that, you know, the greatest ones don't come from France or not Germany, but they have a long history in Germany. They have a long relationship with various geographies there, and I think they're making some extraordinary wines there.
If you take something like Pinot Gris, it's not called Pinot Gris.
Yeah, exactly. So Germany, you know, it's a different language. It's not. It's German. So they tend to call these the Burgundian varietals, so Burgunder.
So they use the word Burgunder.
They use Burgunder, and then they put the colors there, right? So Grau is gray. Blanc, Weiss is white, right? So it's
Weiss Burgunder
is Pinot Blanc.
Okay, Pinot Gris,
Grau Burgunder,
and is Pinot Noir Noir?
No, Pinot Noir is the late, you know, within Germany for whatever reason. I don't know where the origin of this is, but it's the late harvest Burgundy. So it's Spät, which is late in German. So it's Spät Burgunder. So you have Weiss Burgunder, Pinot Blanc, Grau Burgunder, Pinot Gris, and then Spät. Late Burgundy, which is Pinot Noir.
And then you recently got a nice shout out from Eric Asimov
in
the New York Times for a wine that we haven't even mentioned.
Yeah, Sylvaner.
Sylvaner.
Man, that would, I would, you know, my next one for sure would be Sylvaner, because Sylvaner is, again, probably not at the top of the apex right up there with Riesling, but man, it's like, it's second lieutenant to Riesling. Sylvaner is a profoundly noble grape. And by that, you know, what does that mean? Noble grape refers to just a grape that one can express something unique about a place, meaning it tastes different if you plant it in various places, and two, that it can age and develop and change, right? And so Sylvaner does all that. Sylvaner planted in limestone versus Sylvaner planted in sandstone tastes completely different. It is a profound grape, and yeah, that was...
So isn't that truly satisfying? When, you know, Asimov, who's a good guy, who, you know, the Times is very
huge,
you know, reputable.
Yeah.
He picks 20 wines.
Oh, dude.
You're
12.
One of them. Was it 12?
Yeah. Well, there's two articles, right?
Yeah, you're right.
There was an article about Sylvaner that came out in the fall.
Right.
And the whole premise of the article was, why doesn't anyone care about Sylvaner?
Right.
And it was more rooted in Alsace, because there's a long tradition there as well. And they mentioned Vetter, so this producer I work with. But it was, the whole thing was, Sylvaner is so incredible. Why doesn't anyone drink Sylvaner? Which is, you know.
Does that complicate things? Now consumers or restaurants or wine stores want it. And, you know, we talked about how you're a small producer guy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, these things, the wine world and the momentum of consumers and wine stores and restaurants is, you know, it's a big ship. So you turn the wheel a little bit, and it's not like it turns on a dime, right? It's over time. So I'd be lying if I said, you know, one article you know, honestly, unless the wine's under $20 and widely available, I don't know that it steers it so quickly.
Right.
But it's incredibly important for the larger discussion and to have people thinking about it and saying, you know, Asimov is a great writer and a huge personality in the wine. So having him say that these are important, like that puts
reputable and well followed.
That puts thousands of eyes, which is great.
He's this also validating what you're championing, which is a nice thing.
Yeah. No, for sure.
All right. We have about 10, 11 minutes left.
Man, come on.
We got to jam in a lot of things. So I want to move into three areas.
Let's do it.
I want to talk about Riesling Fire.
Yeah.
Two, I want to subject you to our wine list, which is five questions.
All right.
And three, if we can, let's just pick one of the wines you brought in,
taste it, talk about it,
and, you know, get on it. Okay, so Riesling Fire, explain to people what Riesling Fire is.
Yes.
And why you did it.
Right, okay. So people have probably heard of Oktoberfest.
Right.
So Fest in German is like a party, and a fire, it's spelled F-E-I-E-R, fire, is a celebration. It's a little bit more of a formal term, right? So it's Riesling Fire, so we're not, you know, we're not lighting anything on fire. This is more a celebration. So basically it was a way of, there's a number of events. I founded it about 7 years ago, so it's been some time. And back then, there were already a few events, La Palais probably being the most famous. That is, it's basically, it all comes back to a harvest celebration, right? When the harvest was brought in, everyone would get together, thank the gods, thank whoever you thank for these sorts of things, have the bounty of the harvest there, and bring out really nice bottles to share with the community, right? So it's two things. It's one, a celebration of the bounty, of the harvest, of a year, you know, spent circling around the globe and celebrating what happens then. And two, of sharing, of bringing things that are really special to you and opening them with people who you understand will be special too. And so this has been done in Burgundy really successfully. And I thought, you know what, man, I know Germany and Riesling is and probably always will be a bit of a niche geek thing. But like, I know there are people who really care deeply about this. It's a little bit about like being a baseball card collector, right? It's like, you're not going to run into that many people at a dinner party.
You got that right, though.
Yeah, they're not that many people, but at the same time, when you meet someone, like, they care. They care deeply, right?
So there's two elements to the fire.
Yeah, so the fire is basically a big celebration of German wine. There's two events. One is a grand tasting, what I call the grand tasting, which is in New York City, January 19th. So it's a week from this Saturday at Kraft Restaurant. And it is all the growers that are coming in. This year it is from Germany and Austria. There's about, I think, 12 or 11 growers from Germany and three from Austria. And they will be opening, each one will be opening three wines.
So you're looking at up to 50 wines, 50 wines.
Yeah, around 40
wines.
It's a walk around tasting.
Winemakers at the table,
exactly.
Right? Some great New York Psalms.
Exactly. So there's New York Psalms there pouring. There's 14 winemakers. They're opening three bottles each. It's $35. And you get to taste with, you know, some real legends, including Egon Mueller, Keller is there. And then a lot of what, you know, it's always my mix is blue blood and new blood. So it's like, you know, the established guard. And then the young people who are doing cool stuff. So Julian Hart, who I spoke about earlier, is coming in. Ava Fricke, who's a young woman in the Rheingau, is making incredible wine. She'll be there. So it's a lot of like, it's a diverse group. It's neither, you know, the old school aristocrats nor all the punk rockers.
You're not getting a collection in a room
like
that. And
it's
to taste for, what'd you say,
$35? It's ridiculous.
January
19th, so a week from this Saturday.
And then in the spirit of La Palais and the harvest festivals, you do a big dinner.
Exactly right. So then that evening, so it's basically a one-day event, right?
Right.
So during the day, it's this, you know, tickets available now. I think the two shifts still available or something like 1:30 to 3:30 or something
like that.
There's
tickets available for the walk-around tasting.
Yep.
There's multiple shifts.
Exactly right.
Still available.
Yeah.
So and if so all people are interested, they can move on that.
Yep. And it's all RieslingFire.com. So Riesling and then F-E-I-E-R.com.
Now what about the dinner?
So the dinner then that night is with all the growers as well. And this is, you know, this is 10 people at a table. There's 14 growers, so 140 people total. And it's just everyone brings the greatest wines they have. And we crack
open. So there's wine there and people bring wine.
So all the growers bring kind of rare wines from their cellars.
And then the collectors and guests
people are encouraged, you know, it's no one checks you at the door, right? But it's encouraging, you know, it's all in the spirit of sharing. And honestly, a lot of, and this happens to me all the time, it's like you buy a really nice bottle of wine, but like you don't want to open it on Tuesday by yourself or someone who doesn't care. It's like this is the opportunity to open those bottles that you know people. You want to share them with people who care and in this room.
Are there a few tickets left for
that?
There
are a few tickets left for
that
as well.
It's at Reynard at the Wythe Hotel.
Yep.
So if you can make it to Brooklyn that night, January 19th,
And you will taste German wines that you...
These guys pull out
serious,
some...
Yeah. I've had a number of German producers, including Katharina Prum from the famous estate, J.G. Prum, Egon Mueller, Keller as well, who just said, I've never seen this much great German wine in Germany, let alone outside of Germany.
So if you love German wines, Riesling Fire is really a well-curated collection by a guy who's very passionate about it. You could do the tasting, you could do the dinner, you could do both. Yeah. Rieslingfire.com.
Exactly right.
RieslingFeier.
Yep, FEIER. Yep.
All right, so that's what is now Stephen's annual event. All right, let's buzz through the wine list quickly. I got five questions. Right. I ask all my guests this. Don't overthink these. Right. Don't overdwell on
it. I got you.
All right. First question is, what are you drinking now? You know, what's on your table? What are you, is it for business, personal? Is it seasonal?
I mean, it's wine, right?
Yeah, but give me a little
more. But I'm drinking the wines we have here, right? I'm drinking a lot of, I would say during the winter, it's, you know, it tends to be a little bit more light red. So I'm drinking some light.
So you're moving because of the season to be, a little more reds,
a little bit,
and all of that.
You know, richer kind of whites.
Give me one or two things that you're loving right now.
So there's a producer coming in for Riesling Fire, Jochen Beurer.
Spell the last name.
Beurer.
Okay.
And he's in Swabia, which is a little bit further south near Stuttgart, most famous for Mercedes and BMWs. So he makes all different, it's not just Riesling land. He does Trollinger, which is Chiava in Italian. He does a lot of different Cabernets, Portuguese. There's all sorts of reds that are just like tangy, bright, and delicious.
All right, so that's what you're drinking now. How about, this wine list is the Riesling edition.
All right.
Okay, gotcha. Everything relates to Riesling. Favorite wine and food pairing? Do you have one or you don't think about it? Is there something you come back to?
You know,
something so logical?
Yeah, I would say in general, and something probably counterintuitive for people who aren't knee-deep in this stuff, is dry Riesling, which is incredibly high-acid, really sharp cut with any kind of crudo, right? So whether it's like scallops, whether it's, excuse me, shrimp or... even oysters, right? Anything that's a little
crudo is a raw fish.
It tends to be a raw
seasoned,
fish, exactly right.
And it could have some citrus or oil in it.
Because that fattiness, the acid cuts through it. And people, you know, it's always like Riesling is good with spicy foods. It's like, well, dry Riesling is really
so
good.
So dry Riesling and a good fresh crudo.
Oh, man.
Crudo.
Or even Muscadet, man. Or Muscadet. Oysters. Like crack open an oyster and put the Muscadet away.
So that's the German answer to champagne and oysters or Muscadet and oysters, which is good.
Dry Riesling and oysters.
All right.
Pass it on.
You've been around town a lot. I don't want you to leave anyone out, be inclusive, exclusive.
Man.
But in the context of German wines, favorite or good wine restaurant and or bar that has good attention towards, you know, a German, Austrian wine list?
Killing me, Sam. I'm going to not say someone and be in trouble. I would say to go old school, the old school French restaurants do it better than a lot, right? Danielle, Jean-Georges, these places are pouring.
Like Aldo
Le Bernardin as well. Like, they know, right? The acid of Riesling works so well with
guys
food.
Like Raj Vadia, they
for sure.
All that stuff.
So they're doing an incredibly good job. And then you move downtown and, you know, honestly, it's like, man, Roberta's right here. They do
Roberta's.
A decent amount, man. They know what they're doing. Stella, Cafe Altro, those places are doing a lot. You know,
they're
it's Germany
fans.
And Austria, for sure. Yeah, big.
Yeah, so by saying them and, you know, not saying Company or Racine, they're all
they're
doing
all,
a great
yeah, they're
job.
All doing a good job.
So there's a lot of...
For sure.
There's a lot of good places for that. All right, you've drank enough wine. You've had to have something that is a favorite all time. And that doesn't mean necessarily the most expensive, the most rare. What's that wine that you had, you know, through your travels that moved you?
Man, it's always hard to pick like one wine,
give me a couple then.
Yeah,
or
let's
give
say.
Me the experience.
Yeah.
And what was the wine with it?
Yeah, okay. You know what I would say? Let me give you a genre. Can I do that?
Yeah.
All right. My genre would be older cabinets, right? So, you know, for people who don't know, German Riesling is often organized along this hierarchy of sweetness. So you go from
dryness to sweetness.
Exactly. So
go through it.
Yeah. So, you know, you'll see trocken or dry, which means dry. Feinherb or halbtrocken means like slightly off dry. And then this is a newer hierarchy established in the early 70s, but cabinet is the first level. And cabinet, think of it as a style indicator, right? It just tells you kind of what the wine's going to be like. Usually it means it's going to be slightly off dry, have a little residual sugar, but be light and have a lot of acidity. And these are wines historically that are thought of is good wines, but not they're kind of little brother to the Spätleses and Auslese and the noble dessert wines, right? But Cabernet to me is like has all the best of the dry wine world, meaning lots of acidity, lots of vibrancy, energy, but a little bit of residual sugar that gives it complexity and layers. And these Mama Jamas, man, you can age, right? So I, from one of my producers, JB Becker, released a little bit of 75 Cabernet to me.
And how
the
was
wine,
it?
Oh, the wine is like just
lively, it's and
energetic, really? And angelic, transparent. It tastes like satin, salt, and lemon. I mean, it's just absolutely haunting. Another perennial favorite of mine is Von Schubert in the Ruwer Valley, who has cabinets from the 80s. It's a shout out to Raj Vaidya. 88, number 67. That's a vintage 88, cast 67. Right. It's just like a legendary bottle of wine.
All right, good answers. Right. See, it wasn't that hard. All right, I ask everyone this, and if you could fit your stuff in, put it in, if there's something else that makes sense. What's the best Riesling wines we could buy for around $15-$20 that are accessible, reasonable, a little cool?
Yeah.
Retail.
Retailing $15-$20. All right. I can do that. Yeah. So I would say I'm gonna start with Stein just because I think he's a really like interesting producer.
You get Stein for about $20?
Yeah. So he has two entry-level producers. So Stein is just S-T-E-I-N. It means rock, right, in Germany. And what's interesting about Stein is he is farming these like forgotten lands in the Mosel. So he has really old vines. So for about, you know, one is called Blauschiefer Trocken, just means blue slate dry. And this is a wine that's made largely from 80 to 90-year-old ungrafted vines, everything hand-done.
Wow.
Just like incredible viticulture, incredible winemaking. And the wine is $18. And for no reason other than no one knows where this region, like where his little part of the Mosel is. These are not famous vineyards and German wine at large, right? It's silly.
So give me one more.
One more. 15.
Wait, that was a red?
That's a white. That's a dry white. Riesling, right?
You said Riesling.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And then for a Pinot Noir, there's a producer I work with called Shelter that's in Baden. So we're about a half hour drive from Strasbourg, really close to Alsace, and just make delightful Pinot Noirs
in
that are a little bit more
range?
Angelic. Yeah, there's one called Lovely Lily. It's the one critter wine I import. It has a picture of their dog who they love, and his name is Lily. And the wine's, yeah, about $17-$18, and it's just a vibrant, beautiful Pinot Noir on limestone.
Can you find them at the better and obvious
for sure
wine stores,
yes,
in New York?
Yeah, you'll
the
find
Chambers
them. Yes,
and
you'll find
Flatiron
them.
Flatiron or whatever.
Yep.
All right. We're going to wrap the show up, but as we're wrapping the show up, I want you to pick one of the wines. Right, let's talk about it. And
bring your glass on over here there, Sam.
I'm getting up.
All right.
I don't care.
So I'm pouring a Pinot Noir. I think... You know, in the context of a, can we look at one bright part of a
Matt, get some
climate
change. Pinot Noir.
So
give Maddie a little.
I have a sense that in 20 years, German red wines will be as famous, if not as famous as German.
That's
white
what
wines.
I wanted to get to earlier.
I mean,
that reds are breaking through.
It's
so there's going to be some recognition to red
for
wine.
Sure.
So we're drinking a German Pinot Noir.
We're drinking
Noir.
A German
Who's the
Pinot
maker?
Noir. Vassenhaus is the name of the producer.
Spell for me.
W-A-S-E-N. So
okay.
Vassen, you'd say, I guess, in English. And Haus is H-A-U-S. And this is interesting, Sam, because this is at Baden as well, really close to the French border. And there is a massive dialogue now, right, where generation ago, the parents didn't talk. If you were in France or you're in Germany, you didn't talk, right? The younger generation, they travel back and forth constantly. So these are two Germans who have done a lot of work in Burgundy. One of them, and frankly, still works at De Monti, a famous estate in Burgundy. And they make just a little bit of Pinot Noir and Weissburgunder in Baden, and it is like among the greatest
now
German reds I've had in a long time.
I don't want to ask the wrong questions or sound stupid, but is this a typical or a good representation of German Pinot, or because of the area they're in, it's a little different?
It is a good representation of what German Pinot can be.
Okay.
I think it's
so that's
kind of
a good thing.
Yeah.
Because you got your hands on what it should be. You're not hacking
I think,
it is.
I think a big problem, Germany has been able to grow red grapes for a few decades. This is not a totally new thing, but they didn't quite know how to élevage them, how to age them, right? How to like mature them. And now, as I've said, there's a tremendous amount of dialogue. So both these guys were in Burgundy for a long time. These barrels are from Burgundy.
So they got.
So they
the
know
chops.
How to do it now. So there's a little more balance, a little more freshness there. But it's distinctly German. It's called Vulkan. It's referring to the soil type. So this is an area with a lot of volcanic soils, and that's pretty unique to Baden.
So let's just do the vitals. The color is a typical German Pinot. What is that? A garnet or
You tell me. I'm not a color. I'm
it's like a beautiful ruby.
Yeah, it's a light. let's say a light red, right?
Yeah. Give me nose descriptors on this wine.
You know, with volcanic soils, typically you get wild aromatics, and wild just meaning effusive. There's a lot of them, and tend to get a little bit more spicy, right? There's
beautiful
smoke.
Aromatics,
yeah.
Little smoke.
Yeah, a little smoke, little spice, a little kind of game. There's like dried herbs.
All integrated, though.
For sure.
Nice. All right, mouthfeel, it's that typical sort of medium.
I mean, again, typical. I think typically most German Pinot Noir is not that exciting, so I think these are atypical, but it's typical of the potential that can be there, right?
It's got a nice mouthfeel. It's
a little lighter or more delicate, but, you know, some structure to it, so they're doing a little bit of a whole cluster, so it has a little, you know, little grip to it, let's say.
And the palate, does the nose transfer to the palate, or tell me some palate stuff.
I just like making the noise. Palate is just 100% delicious. You know, it's that light, angelic kind of red Pinot Noir fruit with so much just complexity. There's like herbs, there's dirt, there's rock, there's game, there's smoke.
Yeah,
there's meat, right? There's like some like bloody meat there.
That's an interesting wine. It almost sounds like a Northern Rhone you're talking
about. It does a little
bit,
yeah. That's the volcanic
soil.
But
it's a nice wine. I mean, you won't be disappointed. Tell me the wine again.
So Vossenhaus. So they are... What's
the vintage year?
This is... Ooh, that's a good question. 2016, I believe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 2016. It's called Vulcan. V-U-L-K, and just referring to the volcanic soils. Exactly right.
I'm going to post everything on our social media. I'm going to post your wine list answers, and I'll post, you know, the wines that we've been drinking. Before I leave here, let me get a snap. Steven, I have to thank you. We're going to wrap things up. I just got to do a few notices, and then I'm going to get you out of here. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at sbenruby, and follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at benruby. Also subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said, we're going to post Steven's wine list, and we're going to post the weekly wine sip, and I'll post some of the other wines that we drank, and certainly some of the other wines that Steven mentioned. Couple more things. Steven, where could we find you on social media? On Von Boden?
Yeah, exactly. So Von Boden is V-O-M-B-O-D-E-N, so it's Vom like from Boden, which is earth, so from the soil.
Right, so that's Twitter and Instagram.
Hey, Twitter and Instagram. I don't think I'm on Facebook. I'm not sure.
You are.
I am.
There you go. I awesome. Searched and I found
it.
And let's go over one more time. Yes. If you want more info on Riesling Fire, which is coming up in a few weeks, which is why
Saturday.
I asked you to come on. We're actually on vacation this week. Yeah. Our season starts next week, but next week would have been too late.
So I
talked Matt into coming in.
Rad, thank you.
So that we could do that.
Yeah.
So you still have a few tickets left for the dinner and for the tasting. Yeah. So,
and let me make one heartfelt plea, if I may, Sam.
Go ahead.
Because for Riesling Fire, so it is a week from this Saturday, and the gala dinner will be, if you're into these wines, will be an experience you won't forget. It's, you know, it's 300 some bucks, so it's not nothing.
But it's reasonable against all those other la-las.
Right. But if you're not into that, the grand tasting is just in the middle of the day at Craft Restaurant, which is right in Manhattan. It's easy to get to. It's $35, and you are going to be tasting with literally some of the greatest legends of German and Austrian wine. And you're going to taste nearly 40 wines. And like, come, if you know, if you're active in the wine and food world at all, or you're just kind of into it, right, interested in it, you probably hear from people constantly like, Riesling's great, German wines, they sure are coming around. Like, come taste, spend $35 and come see. And like, if you don't leave happy, then I'm wrong.
I said it earlier. It's an incredible value. It's an incredibly passionate and well-curated list. And it's more than an entree into this. It's sort of hitting...
Yeah, it's a little bit of a master course for $35.
Yeah, it's hitting the right spot. So that's RieslingFire.com, RieslingFeier. And you can go to their website. On another note, I told my friend Daniel Jonas that I would talk about one of his la-las. Right. Daniel from La Paulet has created La Table, a daytime tasting and an evening dinner celebrating the wines of the Rhone Valley, north and south. On Saturday, February 2nd in New York City, visit LaTableNewYorkCity.com for more info. So like Stephen was saying, you know, there's a lot of festivals going on. Yeah. There's a Barolo Festival coming up. There's been champagne. Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah, it's
you know, fun, and I'm glad you got your foot in the door and, you know, representing Riesling. I want to thank our guest, Stephen Bitteroff. Stephen is the creator of Riesling Fire. Get online, get out there, try that. And he is the proprietor of Von Boden, which we talked about, curates and imports some delicious German wines and other wines from around the country. I want to thank our engineer, Matt. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Matt.
I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.